Buddhists as a spiritual exercise, and also by happiness experts of all sorts. Nevertheless, I just couldn't bring myself to try meditation. I took yoga twice a week, but my class didn't emphasize the mental aspect of yoga. "I just can't believe you're not practicing meditation," a friend chided me. "If you're studying happiness, you really have to try it." She herself was a veteran of a 10-day silent meditation retreat. The fact that you don't want to try meditation means that you need it desperately. "You're probably right," I sighed, "but I just can't bring myself to do it. It holds no appeal for me." Everyone's happiness project is unique. I enjoyed posting to my blog 6 days a week, a task that some people wouldn't dream of undertaking. But sit in silence for 15 minutes each day, as my friend urged, I couldn't bring myself to do that. Another friend made an eloquent case for why I should spend more time in nature. Both arguments left me cold. When I'd started planning my happiness project, I told myself that I would try everything, but I'd quickly realized that this goal was neither possible nor desirable. Perhaps I'd try meditation in happiness project too, but for now, I would seek happiness in the ways that seemed most natural to me. There were other ways to harness the power of mindfulness, however, apart from meditation. I was already using my resolutions chart, a practice that led me to act more mindfully through the purposeful review of my actions and my thoughts. I filled in my chart at the end of the day, at a quiet time when I was undistracted and alone. Though, given the nature of my personality, this period of self-examination felt more like conversation with Jiminy Cricket than communion with the universe. This month, I sought to find other strategies that would help me pay attention and stay in the moment. I also hoped to stimulate my brain to think in new ways, to jolt myself out of automatic behavior, and to awaken sleepy parts of my mind. Meditate on koans. Although I didn't take up meditation, I did find certain aspects of Buddhism fascinating. I was struck by the symbolism of Buddhism, the way the Buddha was sometimes portrayed by an empty seat, a pair of footprints, a tree, or a pillar of fire to signify that he'd passed beyond form. I loved the numbered lists that pop up throughout Buddhism: the Triple Refuge, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the Eight Auspicious Symbols, Parasol, Golden Fish, Treasure Vase, Lotus, Conch Shell, Endless Knot, Victory Banner, and Dharma Wheel. The aspect that intrigued me most, however, was the study of Zen koans. A koan is a question or a statement that can't be understood logically. Zen Buddhist monks meditate on koans as a way to abandon dependence on reason in their pursuit of enlightenment. The most famous koan is, "Two hands clap and there is a sound. What is the sound of one hand?" Another is, "If you meet the Buddha, kill him." Or, "What was your face before your parents were born?" A koan can't be grasped by reason or explained in words. Meditating on koans promotes mindful thinking because it's not possible to comprehend their meaning with familiar, conventional logic. After I learned about koans, I realized that I already had my own list of personal koans. I just hadn't thought of them that way. For years, in another example of seemingly pointless note-taking, I'd been keeping a list of enigmatic lines, and in odd moments, I'd think about them. I was surprised to see how many I'd collected. My favorites: Robert Frost, "The best way out is always through." J.M. Barrie, "We set out to be wrecked." St. Thérèse of Lisieux, "I choose all." Francis Bacon / Heraclitus, "Dry light is ever the best." Mark 4:25, "For he that hath, to him shall be given, and he that hath not, from him shall be taken even that which he hath." Gertrude Stein, "I like a room with a view, but I like to sit with my back turned to it." Elias Canetti, "Kant catches fire." T.S. Eliot, "Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit." Virginia Woolf, "She always had the feeling that it was very, very dangerous to live even one day. These fragments haunted me. They floated through my mind at odd times, when I was waiting on a subway platform or staring at my computer screen, and they seemed strangely relevant in many circumstances. The personal koan I reflected on most often was a Spanish proverb quoted by Samuel Johnson in Boswell's Life of Johnson. He who would bring home the wealth of the Indies must carry the wealth of the Indies with him. I'd read that line years ago, and I often found myself turning it over in my mind. Much later, I discovered a reference in Henry David Thoreau's journal in which he echoed Johnson. "It is in vain to dream of a wildness distant from ourselves. I shall never find in the wilds of Labrador any greater wildness than in some recess of Concord, i.e., that I import into it." With time, I think I began to grasp the meaning of these two koans, which had profound implications for a happiness project. I was trudging up the stairs of the library when I thought, "She who would find the happiness of the Indies must carry the happiness of the Indies with her." I couldn't look outside myself for happiness. The secret wasn't in the Indies or in Labrador, but under my own roof. If I wanted to find happiness, I had to carry happiness with me. Ruminating on my koans didn't bring me any closer to Satori, the lasting enlightenment promised by Zen, at least not as far as I could tell, but it did ignite my imagination. Because koans forced me to challenge the usual straightforward boxes of meaning, they pushed me to think about thinking. That, in turn, brought me the delicious intellectual happiness that comes from grappling with an expansive, difficult question. Examine true rules. Part of the challenge of mindfulness was to keep myself from falling into mechanical thoughts and actions. Instead of walking through life on autopilot, I wanted to question the assumptions I made without noticing. My research into cognitive science led me to the concept of heuristics. Heuristics are mental rules of thumb, the quick, common-sense principles you apply to solve a problem or make a decision. For example, the recognition heuristic holds that if you're faced with two objects and you recognize one and don't recognize the other, you assume that the recognized one is of higher value. So if you've heard of Munich, but you haven't heard of Minden, you assume that Munich is the larger German city. If you've heard of Rice Krispies cereal, but you haven't heard of Wild Oats cereal, you assume that Rice Krispies is the more popular brand. Usually, heuristics are helpful, but in some situations, our cognitive instincts mislead us. Take the availability heuristic. People predict the likelihood of an event based on how easily they can come up with an example. This is often useful. Is a tornado likely to hit Manhattan? But sometimes a person's judgment is skewed because the vividness of examples makes an event seem more likely than it actually is. A friend of mine, for example, is hypervigilant about not eating anything that might contain raw eggs. She practically went into hysterics when she found out that her mother-in-law had allowed her kids to eat raw cookie batter. Why? Because her aunt got salmonella 25 years ago. This same friend, by the way, never wears a seatbelt. Although they might not fit precisely into the definition of heuristics, I had my own idiosyncratic collection of principles, which I called true rules for making decisions and setting priorities. My father often talks about true rules. For example, when I started working after college, he said, "Remember, it's one of the true rules. If you're willing to take the blame, people will give you responsibility." I've applied my own true rules to help me make decisions, mostly without quite realizing that I was using them. They flicker through my brain so quickly that I have to make a real effort to detect them, but I identified a handful of rules that I frequently use. My children are my most important priority. Get some exercise every day. Jamie is my top priority in matters big or small. Yes comes right away. No never comes. Get some work done every day. Whenever possible, choose vegetables. I know as much as most people. I'm in a hurry. Try to attend any party or event to which I'm invited. My parents are almost always right. Ubiquity is the new exclusivity. If I'm not sure whether to include some text, cut it out. Never eat hors d'oeuvres and never eat anything at a children's party. When making a choice about what to do, choose work. Looking at my true rule showed me something. Several of them were difficult to balance. How could my kids, Jamie, and work all be top priorities? Also, I was pretty sure that Jamie operated under the rule of try to skip as many social events as possible. That explained certain ongoing marital debates. Some of my true rules were very helpful, such as the one I learned from my mother. The things that go wrong often make the best memories. This is very comforting and very true. For example, my mother put a tremendous amount of work into planning Jamie's and my wedding, right down to the wedding weekend informational letter decorated with cows and ruby slippers to symbolize Kansas City. And our wedding was gorgeous and perfect in every way, except for one single tiny detail, the misspelling of the composer Haydn's name as H-A-Y-D-E-N in the order of services. And sure enough, now I love remembering that superfluous E. Somehow it reminds me of all the time my mother and I spent together planning the wedding. She did most of the work. The one flaw throws the loveliness of the whole wedding into focus. I remember reading that the Shakers deliberately introduced a mistake into the things they made to show that man shouldn't aspire to the perfection of God. Flawed can be more perfect than perfection. On the other hand, some of my true rules were unhelpful. "I'm in a hurry" ran through my head dozens of times each day, not always a constructive thought. I worked to change that rule to, "I have plenty of time for the things that are important to me." By questioning my true rules instead of applying them unthinkingly, I could make sure I applied them only when they'd guide me to decisions that reflected my true priorities. Was I the only one who thought this way? When I asked my friends if they had true rules, they understood exactly what I was talking about, and they had their own examples. Always say hello. What would my mother do? Don't get up in the fives or go to sleep in the eights, a.m. or p.m. Down with boredom. Change is good. First things first. Example, eat before a job interview. Choose the bigger life. Buy anything you want at the grocery store. Cooking is always cheaper than eating out. Things have a way of turning out for the best. Use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. I picked up a very helpful true rule from my sister. Elizabeth told me, people succeed in groups. As a TV writer in Los Angeles, she works in a notoriously competitive, jealous industry. Jamie and I had coined a phrase, the funny feeling, to describe the uncomfortable mixture of competitiveness and self-doubt that we feel when a peer scores a major success. When a friend of Elizabeth's co-wrote the screenplay of a movie that was a box office hit, I asked her, "Does it give you the funny feeling that your pal had such a huge success?" She answered, "Well, maybe a bit, but I remind myself that people succeed in groups. It's great for him to have a big success, and his success is also likely to help me to be successful." By contrast, I have a friend who described her brother as having a zero-sum attitude toward good fortune. If something good happens to someone else, he feels as if something good is less likely to happen to him. As a result, he's never happy for anyone else. Now, it's debatable whether it's true that people succeed in groups. I happen to think it is true. But whether or not it's objectively true, it's a true rule that makes a person much happier. Of course, pure magnanimity would be more admirable, but telling yourself that people succeed in groups helps when you're feeling small-minded. Jamie has a very helpful true rule. He says, the first thing isn't the right thing. So when a friend doesn't get the job he wanted or wasn't able to buy the apartment she bid on, Jamie says, the first thing isn't the right thing. Wait and see. You'll be glad in the end that this didn't work out. Again, the point isn't whether this true rule is factually true. I recognize that his precept has the "why do you always find a lost object in the very last place you look?" kind of logical flaw, but that it's a way of thinking that boosts happiness. Gathering true rules was a fun exercise, and it was useful, because as I questioned my true rules, I became far more aware when I applied them. By mindfully deciding how to act in line with my values, instead of mindlessly applying my rules, I was better able to make the decisions that supported my happiness. Stimulate the mind in new ways. As I looked for ways to become more mindful, I realized that using my brain in unfamiliar ways would enhance my experience of the present moment and my awareness of myself. I came up with several strategies. First, I posted sticky notes around the apartment to remind me of the frame of mind I wished to cultivate. The note on my laptop reads, "Focused and observant." The bedroom note reads, "Quiet mind." After I put a note in the master bathroom that read, "Tender and lighthearted," Jamie crossed it out and wrote, "Light and flaky." I had to laugh. The note in my office reads, "Enthusiastic and creative." I also switched on the Breezy Singer Bluebird that I'd bought in May so that the goofy bird song would make me mindful of thoughts of gratitude. A blog reader adopted a similar strategy to stay mindful. Every day, I type passwords into programs and computers too many times to count. I don't save my passwords on the computer, but am a compulsive email checker. So a multitude of times a day, I type the same thing over and over and over. And one day, I realized that what I use for my password gets ingrained in me due to constant repetition. Like a mantra. Let's say my password is tennis. I play tennis, by the way. And although I do not think about tennis on purpose all the time, I eventually realize that it's my favorite activity. It's what I put a lot of time and effort into. It's what I do most outside of work. I later change my passwords to a goal I've been working on or an achievement I want. They become a constant reminder of my goals, my dreams, of what I want to achieve. It's basically the same idea as surrounding yourself with reminders of your aims, your dreams, or repeating positive thoughts in your mind. Next, I decided to try hypnosis as a different route to cultivate my mind. A friend is super suggestible, and her crazy stories about what she'd done under hypnosis had piqued my interest. My first act for October was to take a train to Old Greenwich, Connecticut, to meet Peter, my yoga instructor's cousin, and a hypnotist. I wasn't sure what I thought about hypnotism. Proponents argue that the hypnotic state, with its concentration, boosted relaxation, and increased suggestibility, brings heightened focus and responsiveness to instructions. So hypnosis helps people break bad habits and imprint new patterns on their minds. Or it might be, I speculated, that post-hypnotic change was due to the Hawthorne effect I'd experienced in January. Studying a behavior can lead to its alteration. Or the placebo effect. Treatment works because it's expected to work. Nevertheless, whatever the particular mechanism involved, hypnosis sounded worth a try. As I got into Peter's car in Old Greenwich, I realized that I hadn't done much research on him. It felt a bit odd to be off in some small town in Connecticut, getting into a stranger's car and being driven to his office in a small apartment in a residential building. Fortunately for me, Peter was legitimate. First, he led me through a series of relaxation exercises. Then we talked about the list of aims he'd asked me to bring. I'd included goals small and large, everything from eliminating nighttime snacking to expressing daily gratitude. Then came the actual hypnosis. First, Peter asked me to imagine myself gradually becoming heavier, tracing numbers with my eyes, visualizing my left hand rising into the air. My hand didn't move an inch. Then he slowly instructed me on the behavior that I would change. When I feel myself feeling snappish, I'll remind myself to lighten up. I can make my points more effectively with humor and tenderness than with irritation. When I feel myself getting annoyed because someone is giving me bad service, a pharmacist, a nurse, a clerk, etc., I'll establish a friendly, cooperative tone. I'll remember to cut people slack. As I turn to my computer or sit down to eat or walk down the street, I'll feel happy and grateful for my health, for loving my work so much, for having such a great family, for having such a comfortable life, and from this derive a feeling of lightheartedness, enthusiasm, and tenderness. When I'm listening to other people speak, I will listen intently so that I follow up their comments, laugh at their jokes, engage deeply. No more interrupting or waiting impatiently for my turn. I'll stop overusing the phrases "you know" and "like" and "slang." When I hear myself talking that way, I'll take a deep breath, slow down my speech, and choose my words more carefully. After dinner, I'll turn out the lights in the kitchen and not return. No snacking, no picking at one thing or another. When I'm hungry, I will reach for fresh fruit and vegetables. He counted backward and suggested that I'd wake up feeling refreshed. The whole instruction took about 20 minutes, and Peter had recorded it on an old-fashioned cassette tape. "Listen to this tape each day," he instructed. "You should be relaxed, attentive, and not sleepy. Before bed is the worst time to do it." "Does it really work?" I couldn't resist asking. "I've seen extraordinary results," he assured me. I dug out my old Walkman and bought an extra pair of AA batteries. I listened to the tape each day, and as instructed, each time I heard it, I imagined myself acting according to the goals I had set. Jamie enjoyed making fun of me. He thought the entire exercise was ridiculous. He made a lot of jokes of the "what's going to happen if I tell you to quack like a duck" variety. It was easy to laugh off his teasing, but I got a bit discouraged. I'd hoped to find hypnosis an easy, passive shortcut to self-improvement, but it was a struggle to concentrate on the tape. But I did my best, and I do think it helped. For example, one day I felt enraged because after I had spent about 5 hours putting together an online photo book on Shutterfly, when I logged into my account to complete the finishing touches, it was gone. All I found was empty folder. I was ready to yell, but as I dialed customer service, I heard a soft voice in my ear. "I'll establish a friendly, cooperative tone." And I did. Of course, it helped that the file popped back into existence before too long. I also stopped eating brown sugar out of the jar. Gross, but something that I did do quite frequently. To me, the effectiveness of hypnosis seemed less a result of hypnotic suggestibility and more a result of mindfulness. My hypnosis tape made me more aware of my thoughts and actions, and I was able to change them through a sort of mental practice. But that was fine, as long as it worked. For my next experiment, I decided to try laughter yoga. Founded by an Indian doctor, this combination of yoga and laughter has spread rapidly around the world, and I kept running into references to it as a happiness-inducing activity. Laughter yoga combines clapping, chanting, breathing, and stretching exercises drawn from yoga to calm the mind and body, and the simulated laughter provoked by the exercises often turns into real laughter. One joy of living in New York City is that everything is on offer. I easily located a laughter yoga class near my apartment and showed up one Tuesday evening in the basement conference room of a physical therapy office. 12 of us were led through exercises of yoga breathing and simulated laughter. We did the lion exercise, the ho-ho-ho, ha-ha-ha exercise, the cry-laugh exercise, and several others, and I could tell that many other practitioners were really feeling a boost in mood. 2 people, in particular, collapsed in fits of real laughter. Not me. The leader was kind and knowledgeable, the other people were pleasant, and the exercises seemed purposeful, but all I felt was a horrible self-consciousness. As I'd walked into the class, I'd vowed that I'd try it at least 3 times, but by the time I left, I decided that as much as folks praised laughter yoga and as valuable as novelty and challenge were to happiness, and even though an exercise in mindful laughter sounded like an excellent idea, laughter yoga wasn't for me. I moved on to drawing. I hadn't done any drawing or painting since high school, so taking a drawing class would awaken a part of my mind that had long lain dormant. Also, if cultivating mindfulness meant striving to develop non-judgmental awareness, I suspected that drawing would be a good challenge. It would be hard not to judge my non-existent drawing skill. I'd read about a drawing on the right side of the brain class that claimed to be able to change the way in which people processed visual information, so anyone could learn to draw. Perfect. I figured that, as with laughter yoga, I'd be able to find a drawing on the right side of the brain class in Manhattan. And sure enough, the class was offered by the program's principal New York instructor, right in his own apartment in Soho. I indulged in a modest splurge, signed up, and for 5 days took the subway downtown for a day that started at 9:30 a.m. and ended at 5:30 p.m. Novelty and challenge bring big boosts in happiness. Unfortunately, novelty and challenge also bring exhaustion and frustration. During the class, I felt intimidated, defensive, and hostile, at sometimes almost panicky with anxiety. I felt drained each night, and my back hurt. I'm not sure why it was so stressful, but trying to follow the instructor's directions, squint, measure against my upheld thumb, and draw a straight line on a diagonal was physically and even emotionally taxing. One person in our little class had a kind of breakdown and quit after 3 days. Yet it was also tremendously gratifying to learn something new, to partake of the atmosphere of growth. Drawing exercised an unaccustomed part of my brain, but apart from that, just the fact that I was taking a class boosted my mindfulness. Being in a different neighborhood at an unusual time of day heightened my awareness of my surroundings. New York City is so beautiful, so endlessly compelling. The rhythm of the day was very different from my typical schedule. I enjoyed meeting new people. Plus, the class worked. I drew my hand. I drew a chair. I drew a self-portrait that, although it didn't look much like me, did look like an actual person. The drawing class was a good illustration of one of my secrets of adulthood. Happiness doesn't always make you feel happy. Activities that contribute to long-term happiness don't always make me feel good in the short term. In fact, they're sometimes downright unpleasant. From drawing, I turned to music, another dormant part of my mind. According to research, listening to music is one of the quickest, simplest ways to boost mood and energy and to induce a particular mood. Music stimulates the parts of the brain that trigger happiness, and it can relax the body. In fact, studies show that listening to a patient's choice of music during medical procedures can lower the patient's heart rate, blood pressure, and anxiety level. Nevertheless, one of the things that I have accepted about myself as part of being Gretchen is that I don't have much appreciation for music. I wish I enjoyed music more, but I don't. Every once in a while, though, I fixate on a song I really love. Recently, I went through an obsession with the Red Hot Chili Peppers' Under the Bridge. The other day, while writing in a coffee shop, I overheard a song that I love but had forgotten about, Fatboy Slim's Praise You. I went home, loaded it onto my iPod, and listened to it that night while I was cleaning my office. This song flooded me with tender feelings for Jamie. Yes, we have gone through the hard times and the good. Yes, I have to praise him like I should. This would have been a good activity for February, the month of marriage. I thought again about Young playing with blocks to recapture the passionate engagement of his boyhood. When I was little, I used to dance around the room to my favorite music. I was too young to read, so I asked my mother to mark the record of the Nutcracker Suite so I'd be able to find it. But I stopped dancing when I got older. Maybe I should try dancing around the room again. I didn't want anyone walking in on me while I was doing it, and it took a long time before I had an opportunity. I hadn't realized before how rare it was for me to be home alone. Finally, one Sunday afternoon, I told Jamie I was going to stay behind when he took the girls around the corner to visit his parents. After the apartment was empty, I went into our bedroom, turned off the lights, lowered the blinds, and put my iPod into an iPod speaker base. I had to squelch thoughts of self-criticism, that I was a bad dancer or looked goofy. It was fun. I did feel goofy, but I also felt energized and exhilarated. I started thinking more about music. I thought I'd accepted the fact that, as part of being Gretchen, I didn't really like music. But in fact, the truth was slightly different. I thought I didn't like music, but in fact, I didn't approve of my own taste. I wished I liked sophisticated music, like jazz or classical or esoteric rock. Instead, my taste ran mostly to what might play on a light FM station. Oh well, be Gretchen. Listening and dancing to music absolutely boosted my feelings of mindfulness. I felt much more aware of music during the day. As I worked in a diner, I really heard ABBA singing Take a Chance on Me over the loudspeaker. This heightened responsiveness to my environment made me feel more present in the moment. Instead of tuning music out, I made music a bigger part of my experience. Keep a food diary. I also wanted to apply the principles of mindfulness in a much less elevated context, my eating habits. Studies show that merely being conscious of eating makes people eat more healthfully. And one way to encourage yourself to eat more mindfully, experts agree, is to keep a food diary. Without a record, it's easy to overlook what you eat without noticing it. Grabbing 3 Hershey's Kisses every time you pass a coworker's desk throughout the day, or eating leftovers from other people's plates as you clear the kitchen table. In one study, dieters who kept a food diary lost twice as much weight as dieters who didn't bother. I'd felt guilty for a long time about my mediocre eating habits, and I wanted to eat more healthfully. Plus, I wanted to lose a few pounds without going on a diet. Hardly an original goal. Almost 7 out of 10 Americans say they're trying to eat healthfully to lose weight. Making notes about the food I ate sounded easy enough, and I figured that, of all my various resolutions, this would be one of the easier ones to keep. I bought myself a little notebook. I keep a food diary, a friend told me at lunch soon after, when I mentioned my latest resolution. She showed me her calendar, which was crammed with tiny writing detailing her daily intake. I update it every time I eat. They say that keeping a food diary helps you eat better and lose weight, I said, so I'm giving it a try. It's a great thing to do. I've been keeping mine for years. Her recommendation reassured me that the food diary was a good idea. My friend was thin and fit, plus she was one of the healthiest, if also one of the most eccentric, eaters I knew. I just heard her order lunch. I'd like the Greek salad, chopped. No dressing, no olives or stuffed grape leaves, plus a side order of grilled chicken and a side order of steamed broccoli. When the food arrived, she heaped the chicken and broccoli onto the salad. It was a lot of food, but tasty and very healthy. I ordered the same salad, but without the extra chicken and broccoli. Before we dug in, we sprinkled artificial sweetener over our salads. She taught me this trick. It sounds awful, but artificial sweetener makes a great substitute for dressing. It's like adding salt. You don't taste it, but it brings out the flavor of the food. I refuse to go on a diet, I told her. Oh, me too, she said, but try keeping a food diary. It's interesting to see what you eat over the course of a week. I tried it. My problem? I found it practically impossible to remember to keep a food diary. I've read repeatedly that it takes 21 days to form a habit, but in my experience, that just isn't true. Day after day, I tried, but only rarely did I manage to remember to record everything I ate in a day. One problem with not being very mindful, it turns out, is that you have trouble keeping your mindfulness records. Nevertheless, even attempting to keep a food diary was a useful exercise. It made me more attuned to the odds and ends I put into my mouth, a piece of bread, the last few bites of Eleanor's lasagna. Most important, it forced me to confront the true magnitude of my fake food habit. I'd pretended to myself that I indulged only occasionally, but in fact, I ate a ton of fake food. Pretzels, low-fat cookies or brownies, weird candy in bite-sized portions, and other not very healthy snacks. Food that comes in crinkly packages from corner delis, as one friend described my weakness. I liked eating fake food because when I got hungry during the day, it was more convenient to grab something fake than to sit down to eat proper food like soup or salad. Plus, fake food was a treat. I'd never buy a real chocolate chip cookie or a candy bar, but I couldn't resist the supposedly low-cal version. Even though I knew that this kind of food was low in nutrition and high in calories, I kept eating it, and this habit was a daily source of guilt and self-reproach. Each time I thought about buying some fake food, I told myself that I shouldn't. but then I did anyway. I'd tried and failed to give up fake food in the past, but the food diary, incomplete as it was, made me aware of how much fake food I was eating. I gave up fake food cold turkey, and it felt good to give it up. I'd thought of these snacks as treats, and hadn't realized how much feeling bad they'd generated, feelings of guilt, self-neglect, and even embarrassment. Now those feelings were gone. Just as I'd seen in July, when I was thinking about money, keeping a resolution to give something up can be surprisingly satisfying. Who would have thought that self-denial could be so agreeable? I told my sister what I'd done, and she answered, very sensibly, "You basically eat a very healthy diet, so why give up fake food altogether? Limit yourself to a few treats each week." "Nope, can't do it," I told her. "I know myself too well to try that. When it comes to fake food, I'm like Samuel Johnson, who remarked, abstinence is as easy to me as temperance would be difficult. In other words, I can give something up altogether, but I can't indulge occasionally." It's true, I have a very particular definition of fake food. I still drink a huge amount of Diet Coke and Fresca. I still use a ton of artificial sweetener. I also eat a fair amount of candy, which I consider real and not fake. But no more crinkly packages from corner delis, and that's a real step forward. Bananas, almonds, oatmeal, tuna sandwiches, and salsa on pita bread are filling the gap. My fake food experience showed me why mindfulness helps you break bad habits. When I became truly aware of what I was eating, I found it much easier to change the automatic choices I'd been making. Two or three times a day, I'd mindlessly been picking up snacks in corner delis. But when I was confronted with what I was doing, I wanted to stop. And it was only after I'd kicked my fake food habit that I realized what a drain it had been on my happiness. Every day, I felt uncomfortable twinges of self-reproach because I knew that kind of food wasn't healthy. Once I stopped that habit, that relentless source of bad feeling vanished. The mindfulness resolutions for October had been interesting and productive and had boosted my happiness considerably. But more important, my increased awareness had led me to an unrelated yet significant realization. I was at risk of turning into a happiness bully. I'd become much more sensitive to people being negative, indulging in knee-jerk pessimism, or not having what seemed to me the right spirit of cheerfulness and gratitude, and I felt a strong impulse to lecture, which I didn't always manage to resist. Instead of following June's resolution to cut people slack, I was becoming more judgmental. My desire to be a happiness evangelist made me want to meddle. When a guy told me that he hated making small talk and so whiled away the dull hours of a dinner party by doing complex math problems in his head, or when a young woman told me that she was going to dental school because she liked the hours the dentist work, but that her fantasy was one day to do something involving flowers because flowers were her true passion, I could barely contain myself. "No," I wanted to tell them, "you're making a mistake. I'll tell you why." I'd become a happiness bore. In a scene right out of a Woody Allen movie, I practically got into a fist fight with someone about the nature of Zen. "You seem quite attached to the theory of non-attachment," I said snidely. I kept interrupting. I wouldn't shut up. I was such a crusader for the idea of doing a happiness project that I found myself practically shouting people down. In particular, I kept trying to force clutter clearing onto my friends. My clutter was mostly gone, and I craved the vicarious thrill I got from tackling a truly messy closet. "Listen," Jamie warned me one night, "you mean well, but you're going to offend people if you keep pushing them so hard to clear their clutter." "But every time I help someone clear their clutter, they're thrilled," I said. "It's okay to suggest it, but don't press the issue. You want to be nice, but you might end up rubbing someone the wrong way." I remembered how recently I'd walked into a friend's apartment and immediately offered clutter-clearing help anytime she wanted it. Even at the time, it occurred to me that she might have found my reaction a bit rude. "Okay, you're right," I admitted. "I'll ease up on people." I called my sister. "Am I annoying you with all my talk about happiness?" I asked. Of course not, Elizabeth said. Do you think I seem happier? Sure. How can you tell? Well, you seem much lighter, more relaxed, and you're not snapping as much. Not, she added quickly, that you snapped a lot, but you know. I've been trying to keep my temper. Probably the fact that you noticed means that I was snapping more than I realized. You also seem like you're better about finding the fun in things. Like what? Like when we were talking about how to do Eliza's hair for my wedding. That's the kind of thing that might have made you tense before, but now you're just letting her have fun with it without worrying about it too much. Anyway, did I tell you that you've inspired me to try some of your resolutions? Really? That's great. What have you been doing? I was thrilled to think that my happiness project had influenced someone else. For one thing, I'm trying to exercise a lot more. Pilates, hiking, cardio bar. I've never had a hobby, so I'm trying to think of exercise as my hobby. You know, reframing. That way it covers fitness and also the atmosphere of growth. Also, my dentist has been after me for years to get my teeth fixed, so I finally tackled a nagging task and got Invisalign put in. I've been eating at home more often. It's healthier and cheaper. And I've been going away more on the weekends, spending money in ways that will make me happy. And are these things making you happier? Yes, you're right. It really does work. I was actually kind of surprised. Chapter 11, November. Keep a contented heart. Attitude. Laugh out loud. Use good manners. Give positive reviews. Find an area of refuge. My happiness project year was almost over, and for November's resolutions, I had to make sure to cram in everything that I hadn't covered. Fortunately, everything I had left to cover fit neatly into one category. Instead of focusing on my actions, I focused on my attitude. I wanted to cultivate a lighthearted, loving, and kind spirit. If I could put myself into that frame of mind, it would be easier to stick to all my other resolutions. The British diarist Samuel Pepys reflected from time to time on the nature of happiness. In his entry for February 23, 1662, he wrote, "This day, by God's mercy, I am 29 years of age, and in very good health, and like to live and get an estate, and if I have a heart to be contented, I think I may reckon myself as happy a man as any is in the world, for which God be praised. So to prayers and to bed." This last phrase, "and so to bed," is Pepys' signature sign-off, much like Walter Cronkite's "and that's the way it is," or Ryan Seacrest's "Seacrest out." I was struck by Pepys' inclusion of the qualifying phrase, "and if I have a heart to be contented." It was easy to pass over these words without realizing their tremendous importance. No one is happy who doesn't think himself happy. So without a heart to be contented, a person can't be happy. That's the fourth splendid truth. Did I have a heart to be contented? Well, no, not particularly. I had a tendency to be discontented, ambitious, dissatisfied, fretful, and tough to please. In some situations, this served me well, because it kept me constantly striving to improve my work and achieve my goals. In most areas of my life, however, this critical streak wasn't helpful. When Jamie surprised me with a gardenia plant, my favorite flower, I fussed because it was too big. I was deeply annoyed when we came back from the hardware store with the wrong-sized light bulbs. I just couldn't let it go. It's easier to complain than to laugh, easier to yell than to joke around, easier to be demanding than to be satisfied. Keeping a heart to be contented, I expected, would help change my actions. I hit on several specific aspects of my attitude that I wanted to change. First, I wanted to laugh more. Laughing more would make me happier, and it would also make the people around me happier. I'd grown more somber over the last several years. I suspected that I didn't laugh, or even smile, very much. A small child typically laughs more than 400 times each day, and an adult, 17 times. I wondered if I hit even that number most days. Along with a more humorous attitude, I wanted to be kinder. I'd considered kindness a respectable but bland virtue, in the same dull class as reliability and dutifulness, but researching Buddhism, with its emphasis on loving kindness, had convinced me that I'd overlooked something important. I wanted to practice loving kindness, but it was such a vague goal, easy to applaud, but hard to apply. What strategies would remind me to act with loving kindness in my ordinary day? I decided to start with a basic resolution to improve my manners, which weren't as good as they should have been. Not just my table manners, though those weren't great either, but my actions to show consideration for others. Perhaps mere politeness wouldn't engender loving kindness in me, but acting politely would at least give me the appearance of possessing that quality, and perhaps appearance would turn into reality. I wanted to lose my New York City edge. Whenever I go home to visit my parents, I notice that Midwesterners really are more friendly. In Kansas City, people seem less hurried, and they are less hurried. A study showed that New York has the country's fastest walking pedestrians. Clerks in stores are more helpful and chatty. Drivers give pedestrians a lot of space on the street. In New York, they practically nudge you out of the way with their bumpers. Instead of moving fast and speaking curtly, I wanted to take the time to be pleasant. Also, I wanted to stop being so critical, so judgmental, and finicky. When I was growing up, my parents placed a lot of emphasis on being positive and enthusiastic, to the point that my sister and I sometimes complained that they wanted us to be fake. Now I'd grown to admire my parents' insistence on banning sarcasm and pointless negativity. It made for a much nicer household atmosphere. Finally, as a way to help myself stay serene and cheerful, I resolved to discipline myself to direct my thoughts away from subjects that made me angry or irritable. I wondered whether working on my attitude should occupy an entire month's worth of resolutions, but reading Schopenhauer, oddly enough, given that he's so well known for his pessimism, convinced me of the importance of a cheerful disposition. Whoever is merry and cheerful has always a good reason for so being, namely the very fact that he is so. Nothing can so completely take the place of every other blessing as can this quality, whilst it itself cannot be replaced by anything. A man may be young, handsome, wealthy, and esteemed. If we wish to judge of his happiness, we ask whether he is cheerful. This month was all about cheerfulness. Laugh out loud. By now, I had no doubt about the power of my third commandment, act the way I want to feel. If I want to feel happy and lighthearted, I need to act that way, say, by laughing out loud. Laughter is more than just a pleasurable activity. It can boost immunity and lower blood pressure and cortisol levels. It increases people's tolerance for pain. It's a source of social bonding, and it helps to reduce conflicts and cushion social stress within relationships, at work, in marriage, among strangers. When people laugh together, they tend to talk and touch more and to make eye contact more frequently. I vowed to find reasons to find things funny, to laugh out loud, and to appreciate other people's humor. No more polite smiling, no more rushing to tell my story before the laughter has died after a friend's funny story, no more reluctance to be joshed and teased. One of life's most exquisite pleasures is making people laugh. Even Jamie seems more pleased with himself when I laugh out loud at his jokes, and it's almost heartbreaking to see Eliza and Eleanor gaze into my face to watch me laugh. The other morning, after Eleanor told me the same garbled knock-knock joke for the 10th time, I saw her lower lip start to tremble. "What's wrong, Munchkin?" I asked. "You didn't laugh," she yowled. "Tell me again," I said. She did, and the next time I laughed. Most of all, though, I wanted to laugh out loud at myself. I took myself far too seriously. On the rare occasions that I did manage to laugh at myself, it was very cheering. This topic was on my mind when I was stuck in a slow-moving line at a soup place. No more fake food for me. Two older women at the head of the line were taking a long time to make their selections. "Can I try the spicy lentil?" asked one woman. She got her miniature cup of soup, tasted it, and said, "Too spicy. Can I try the spicy sausage?" The clerk behind the counter moved slowly to ladle out another miniature cup and pass it over the counter. "This one is too spicy, too," the tasting woman exclaimed. The clerk shrugged without saying a word, but I could read her mind. "Lady, that's why the soups are labeled spicy." I was feeling very proud of myself for not losing my patience at this exchange, but the muttering behind me suggested that others weren't being quite so high-minded. Just then, the tasting woman turned to her friend and said, "Oh, listen to me! I sound like someone from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Make me stop." She burst out laughing, and her friend joined in. I couldn't help laughing, and the people behind me started laughing too. It was astounding to see how this woman's ability to laugh at herself transformed a moment of irritation into a friendly moment shared by strangers. It was difficult, however, to devise a way to make myself laugh more, at myself or anything else. I couldn't figure out a clever exercise or strategy to get myself yucking it up. I considered watching a funny TV show each night or lining up a series of comedy DVDs to rent, but that seemed forced and time-consuming. I didn't want to get stressed out about my laugh sessions. Was I really so humorless that I had to employ these extreme, unspontaneous measures? In the end, I just reminded myself, listen and laugh. I slowed myself down to give people the big reaction that they craved. Chesterton was right. It is hard to be light. Joking around takes discipline. It took willpower to listen to Eliza's endless, convoluted riddles and to laugh at the punchlines. It took patience to give Eleanor the laugh she expected the millionth time she popped her head out from behind a pillow. But they were so tickled to get me laughing that their delight was a great reward. What started out as forced laughter often turned real. I also made an effort to pay more attention to things I found funny. For example, I'm very amused by the phrase that X is the new Y. So, for no reason other than I found it fun, I started a list, also keeping my resolution to forget about results. Sleep is the new sex. Breakfast is the new lunch. Halloween is the new Christmas. May is the new September. Vulnerability is the new strength. Monday is the new Thursday for making plans after work. 3 is the new 2, number of children. 40s are the new 30s, and 11 is the new 13 in age. Why did I find these so funny? No idea. I had the chance to laugh at myself when a book review mentioned the newly popular genre of stunt nonfiction. "Look at this," I said to Jamie, rattling the paper in his face. "I'm part of a genre, and not just a genre, but a stunt genre, method journalism." "What's the stunt?" "Spending a year doing something." "What's wrong with that? Thoreau moved to Walden Pond for a year. Well, for 2 years, but same idea." "It makes my happiness project sound so unoriginal and dumb," I wailed. "Plus, I'm not even the only one writing stunt nonfiction about happiness. Unoriginal, dumb, and superfluous." Then I remembered. I knew better. Feeling defensive and anxious wasn't the way to happiness. Laugh out loud, make fun of myself, act the way I want to feel, reframe. "Oh well," I said, switching suddenly to a lighthearted tone. "I'm part of a movement without knowing it. I miss the dot-com boom. I barely know how to use an iPod. I don't watch Project Runway, but for once, I managed to tap right into the zeitgeist. I forced myself to laugh, and I instantly felt better." Jamie started laughing too. He also looked quite relieved that he wasn't going to have to try to jolly me out of a funk. Laughing out loud went beyond mere laughter. Responding with laughter meant that I had to give up my pride, my defensiveness, my self-centeredness. I was reminded of one of the climactic moments in St. Teresa's life, a moment when she decided to laugh out loud. Typical of the extraordinarily ordinary nature of Teresa's saintliness, she pointed to a seemingly unremarkable episode as a turning point in her spiritual life. Every Christmas, she delighted in the ritual of opening the presents left in her shoes, the French version of hanging up stockings. But one year, when she was 14, she overheard her father complaining, "Well, fortunately, this will be the last year." Accustomed to being babied and petted by her family, the young Therese burst into tears at any cross or critical word, and this kind of unkind comment would ordinarily have caused her to dissolve into sobs. Instead, as she stood on the stairs, she experienced what she described as her complete conversion. She forced back her tears, and instead of crying at her father's criticism, scorning his gifts, or sulking in her room, she ran down and opened the presents joyfully. Her father laughed along with her. Therese realized that the saintly response to her father's exasperation was to laugh out loud. Use good manners. As part of my research, I'd taken the Newcastle Personality Assessor Test, which I'd found in Daniel Nettle's book Personality, and my results reminded me that I needed to work harder to use good manners. This test is short, just 12 questions, but purportedly provides an accurate assessment of an individual's personality using the Big Five model that has emerged in recent years as the most comprehensive, dependable, and useful scientific framework. According to this five-factor model, people's personalities can be characterized by their scores in five major dimensions. 1, extroversion, or response to reward. 2, neuroticism, or response to threat. 3, conscientiousness, or response to inhibition, self-control, planning. 4, agreeableness, or regard for others. 5, openness to experience, or breadth of mental associations. I'd always thought extroversion was basically friendliness, but according to this scheme, a high extroversion score means that people enjoy very strong positive reactions, so that they consistently report more joy, desire, excitement, and enthusiasm. And although I'd often thrown around the word neurotic, I hadn't quite grasped what it meant. Turns out that people with high neuroticism scores have very strong negative reactions. Fear, anxiety, shame, guilt, disgust, sadness, very often directed at themselves. After answering the 12 questions, I totted up my score. Extroversion, low medium. Neuroticism, low medium. Conscientiousness, high. Agreeableness, low. For a woman. If I were a man, I'd be low medium. Openness to experience, high. The result struck me as quite accurate. As I'd acknowledged to myself on that subway ride back in April, when I'm in neutral, I'm neither particularly joyful nor particularly melancholy. I'm low medium. I'm very conscientious. I was pleased to see that I scored high on openness to experience. I wasn't sure how I'd do there. Most significant, I wasn't surprised by my low agreeableness score. I knew that about myself. When I mentioned to some friends that I'd scored low on agreeableness, like true friends, they all cried as one, "Surely not! You're very agreeable." I suspect that my friends, as evidenced by their loyal reaction, are more agreeable than I. "Nothing," wrote Tolstoy, "can make our life, or the lives of other people, more beautiful than perpetual kindness. Kindness in everyday life takes the form of good manners, and one way that my low agreeableness showed itself was in my thoughtless habits. I rushed past people on the sidewalk. I didn't often check to see if anyone needed my subway seat. I wasn't careful to say, 'You first,' 'No, you take it,' or 'Can I help?' In particular, to be more agreeable and kind, I needed to use better manners as a conversationalist. I was a know-it-all. A really interesting feature of Angela Thirkell's novels is that she sets them in Barsetshire, the imaginary English county described by Trollope. I was a topper. You think you had a crazy morning. Let me tell you about my morning. I was a deflator. You liked that movie? I thought it was kind of boring. So, to try to cure these tendencies, I looked for opportunities to make comments that showed my interest in other people's viewpoints. You're right. You have a good memory. Tell everyone that story about how you... I hadn't thought about that before. I see your point. What do you think? Once I started focusing on my conversational style, I realized I had one particular characteristic that I